not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
Billie Holiday left an indelible mark on American popular culture during her brief, often troubled life. All of her recordings remain in print, and she's been acknowledged by a wide range of singers, from Frank Sinatra to Macy Gray, as their major influence. It can be argued that she is at least as popular and influential today as she was when she died on July 17, 1959, 50 years ago tomorrow. We thought that we would take this occasion to celebrate her legacy, and we've invited the distinguished jazz writer Dan Morgenstern to talk about her. Mr. Morgenstern, a six-time Grammy Award winner, has served as editor of Metronome, Jazz, and Downbeat magazines, and for the past 33 years, he's been the director of Rutgers University's Institute for Jazz Studies, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi, Dan.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
The headline of her obituary in the New York Times in 1959 was, "Billie Holiday dies here at 44. Jazz singer had wide influence." So even then, people were thinking about the influence. Are you surprised by how, if anything, her popularity has grown over the half century since she died?
Not really, because Billie Holiday was unique. She was very special, and there hasn't been anyone like her since. And even, you know, young people respond to her because she has such a direct emotional impact, and it remains.
And she seems to have moved past simply appealing to jazz audiences. She was ranked number 6 on VH1's 100 Greatest Women in Rock and Roll some years ago.
Really? I didn't know.
She was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000. And U2 recorded a homage to her called Angel of Harlem. There's a new crop of singers: Macy Gray, Madeleine Peru, Claire Teal, even David Sedaris of Public Radio, who seemed to be channeling her. Is her style easy to imitate?
Well, it's still not a surprise to me, because even during her lifetime, you know, her influences ranged very widely. Frank Sinatra was a huge fan, used to come and hear her on 52nd Street, and you can hear how she influenced him. And she cut across boundaries then as well as she is doing now.
The influence with Frank Sinatra, largely phrasing?
Yes, phrasing and feeling, and her ability to take what in some cases was quite tawdry material and do astonishing things with it, just by virtue of what she could put into a song.
Tawdry material, because the best new songs went to the most popular singers, the ones who are most likely to sell a lot of records, and she sometimes got what was left over.
Well, she also got a fair share of very good songs, but even early in her career. She was actually the first to record Summertime outside of the, you know, actual Porgy and Bess operatic. She did great songs like A Fine Romance, Man I Love, Night and Day, all those in the 30s. So it wasn't that she was exclusively relegated to drugs. But, you know, even Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, of course, was a master. They threw a lot of, you know, crappy songs at him because he could work miracles with them, and so could she.
Well, Louis Armstrong is one of the obvious influences on her. She said Louis and Bessie Smith. Do you hear it?
Oh, sure. She loved Louis, and especially in her earlier work. You know, we all know Phil Shapp, and sometimes Phil is great, but sometimes he talks too much. But sometimes he does interesting things, and he did something a few years ago. He took Billy's version of Pennies from Heaven, which is from the year the song came out in the Bing Crosby movie, and he slowed it down. And if you listen to that, she sounds so remarkably like Armstrong.
Some suggest the influence of Lester Young as well on the way she almost sounded like a tenor saxophone. And I was thinking about that when I was listening to her performance of Duke Ellington's Solitude. Maybe we can listen to a little bit of that.
In my solitude,
It really does sound like a saxophone, doesn't it?
Well, the way she phrases and the way she stretches things. And also one thing that she and Lester and Louis Armstrong and Bessie have in common is remarkable time. I mean, she could do a slow tempo like what we just heard, but it has an internal rhythmic thrust.
You're still tapping your foot.
It never lags. And that, of course, she and Lester, the things they did together, it's like a musical marriage made in heaven. The Sailboat in the Moonlight and Me, Myself, and I, and those things are just incredible.
Another marriage made in heaven was Billy with Teddy Wilson. And they just seem to be perfect with each other. She recorded first as the vocalist with his groups, and then later he became the accompanist for her.
Yes. It's a funny thing about Teddy, though, that you should mention it. We have an interview with Teddy that was done long after Billy's death with Milt Hinton, and he speaks very freely about a lot of things. And Milt asks him about Billy, and he says, of course, I like Billie Holiday, but she was not my favorite singer. He said, to me, she sounded like a female Louis Armstrong. And he loved Louis, too, but that was his taste. And then he said, I like Ella. And then he mentioned a singer named Beverly White, who quite frankly is terrible, as somebody that he liked better than Billy. I think one of the things involved there was that the Billie Holiday, Teddy Wilson things were reissued for years and years under her name, and he had been the leader on it, and there's a little bit of jealousy there.
My guest is Dan Morgenstern. We're talking about Billie Holiday, who died 50 years ago tomorrow, and has had an impact I think she's probably, after Louis Armstrong, the most influential jazz singer. And interestingly, Teddy liked Ella Fitzgerald, who had a much more beautiful voice. Billie's voice is not beautiful, and as time goes on, it gets more and more raspy and deteriorates because of the circumstances of her life, drug abuse and alcohol abuse.
Yeah, she had a very narrow compass anyway, just about an octave, not much more. And it declined as she went along, as you said. But she was still able to make a very musical statement with that limited equipment.
And not everybody liked her or the quality of her voice. The Amsterdam News always seemed to give her lukewarm notices for some reason.
Well, if you look at the history of criticism, not only in jazz, but in general, you'll find a lot of things like that.
Well, do you think that that the fans all understood that she was living this incredibly tough life and gave her a lot of slack?
I think certainly her fans always wanted her to surmount all these problems that she had. And many of them were self-inflicted, of course, but we were all always rooting for her. And near the end, it was so sad to see it, but everybody wanted her to make it. The last time I saw Billie was at Lester Young's funeral, which Lester died in March of the same year. And she wanted to sing. And the family is very proper. They wouldn't let her. And I was one of a bunch of her friends who took her outside because she kept saying, they won't let me sing, those MFs won't let me sing. So we took her downstairs, Bud Johnson and Paul Quinichet.
Two great tenor players.
Yeah. And we took her to, there was a bar next door, and we got her calmed down. But she was, it would have been such a thing for her to sing for Lester. It would have been incredible.
And she was able to pull it together at times at the end. She did this amazing television show for CBS where she just sings beautifully, very relaxed. I saw her in this concert very close to the end of her life. The one that most people remember is Thelonious Monk with John Coltrane. But she was the final act, if I remember correctly.
Oh, you were there.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Well, I was a kid. I probably complained about the quality of her voice and didn't get an awful lot of what I was seeing. But still, she every once in a while, she somehow, I guess if she was in the right context, she would do amazing things. Yeah.
That television show, The Sound of Jazz, where she does that fine and mellow with everybody, including Lester Young, and that is so poignant, you know, the exchange between her and Lester and the way she looks at him. It's
been said that her personal sufferings were integral to her music, and songs like Don't Explain, Good Morning Heartache, God Bless the Child, which she wrote the lyrics to, or at least is credited with lyrics to any number of songs?
Yes, she had a little help with those, but basically the message is hers, absolutely.
God bless the child. And they feel autobiographical.
Yes, Don't Explain. Yes, and she had, unfortunately, she had very bad taste in men.
Mm-hmm. She made her first recording, Your Mother's Son-in-Law, in November 1933, singing one chorus with a band that included Benny Goodman, Jack Teagarden, Gene Krupa, Joe Sullivan. Should we be surprised that in that era where so much of the music business was segregated, that she would make her first record with a white orchestra?
Well, it actually was a little integral. There was a trumpet player named Shirley Clay, and it was African-American. But no, because Benny Goodman already knew her and liked her. They had actually done some dating. Benny was a terrific dancer. Billy talks about that, how well Benny could dance. So anyway, and John Hammond produced that session, and he was one of the pioneers of integrating at least the recording studios at that time.
But we do hear a major progression as she starts performing with more musicians who are really sympathetic to her, although Benny Goodman played on many of the records over the years with the Teddy Wilson group.
In the first Teddy Wilson session, What a Little Moonlight Can Do is one of Benny's all-time great solos. Yes.
Were you aware of all the problems that she was going through at that time? Because you were already on the scene.
Yes. Most of us who were, in the jazz world were aware of that. Maybe not all the details, but yes, but she could still. When I got out of the army, 1953, I went to Brandeis on the GI Bill. And that was like $110 a month. And Billy came to Boston, and there's a club there called the Hi Hat, which was frequently closed because they had fires, which were usually set by the owners.
So they could collect insurance
money. But anyway, I went with, it was my first girlfriend after I got out of service. And the first set was so wonderful that we decided to stay for another set. And which I could ill afford. And then it was on a weekend night, so there were three sets. And when we decided to stay for the last one as well, she came over to the table and sat down with us. And me, I said, Miss Holiday, can I buy you a drink? And she said, no, why don't you let me buy you one? And that actually was a lifesaver. But she was so sweet. But that night was such an incredible performance.
And despite her problems, she still had a very strong will, as she insisted on recording Strange Fruit at a time when that was considered a rather brave thing.
Well, she had to be prodded a little bit. I think Barney Josephson, who was the owner of Cafe Society, there's a whole book about Strange Fruit now.
And David Margolin.
Yes. But once she was persuaded to do it, and she saw what impact it had.
And it's been recorded by a number of the songs that she's associated with have been recorded again and again. God Bless the Child has probably been recorded hundreds of times.
Although it was Strange Fruit, except for Josh White, who did it very well, I don't think anybody else should do it. I think that belongs to Billy.
Well, I was thinking about that song now because of the NAACP's convention, since the NAACP was so much involved with anti-lynching movement in its inception. As I said before, tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of Billie Holiday's death, a sad death. She died under very bad circumstances. But the music lives on, and my great thanks to Dan Morgenstern for talking with us today. Dan, you said you have a lot of stuff about her in the Rutgers University Institute for Jazz Studies?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, we have all her recordings, but we also have a lot of interesting clippings and correspondence and stuff.
And we're going to go out.
Lady sings the blues. She's got them bad. She feels so sad. Wants the world to know just what her blues is all about. Lady sings the blues. She tells her sad. Nothing to hide. Now